just on the using the word racism and the sort of racism tag that is thrown around in this debate, I remember quite early on after the election writing that advocates of the Voice need to be careful not to brand people who are no voters as racist automatically. You know, the campaign has to be about swaying people, persuading people, bringing them on board, not simply pushing them into a camp. What surprised me, though, is the extent to which the no case has branded the yes case racist, which is some sort of Trumpian inversion, it seems to me. But this has really taken hold amongst a number of no campaigners who throw around words they have no idea about, like apartheid, have no appreciation for what apartheid actually was and is. And as I say, racism and so forth. I wonder how frustrating that is for you and the extent to which you're able to dissuade people of those things in those face-to-face conversations that you were talking about.
Yeah, 100%. I'm glad you raised this because it's been one of my pet peeves about how it's rolled out. So not kind of a little bit before Albo and a little bit after, some columnists started saying, well, I can't say this because I'm being branded a racist. And, you know, I've followed this forensically for 6 years. I know that there was nothing written where people were branding these columnists racists. In fact, most Australians wouldn't even know that they were going to comment on The Voice, and it has become a kind of pet topic for some. But that's absolutely been generated from day one, and we can track that because you can't, when you see them write the columns, there's actually nobody calling them racist. But it's an effective Trumpian tool that they've used from day one and created now a narrative that where everybody's saying, well, I can't say anything because I'm going to be regarded as racist, and it's simply not true. I mean, the reality of the conversation is that over the past 6 years, the polling was pretty robust because I think the bulk of Australians do support it. But also, when you go out and have these conversations with Australians, a lot of them, you know, went to school with blackfellas or in regional Australia, like they're really cognizant of Aboriginal issues, of course. And our focus group showed that last week that, you know, regional Australians are quite literate about the problems facing Aboriginal Australia. That's not the problem. And so you can have those conversations with Australians and they're not held in the same way that they might have been 20 years ago in the Howard era. Australia is not, today is not John Howard's Australia. In fact, British-born, non-Indigenous Australians, it's very much a brown country now, is what the census stats tell us, what our polling tells us. And so the conversations are really different. They're not about racism. They're conversations about democracy and, you know, will this improve the situation for Aboriginal people? There seems to be a really strong desire for Australians to know that this will make a difference on the ground. But the race stuff isn't prominent, but it is for the no case. I find the apartheid stuff objectionable, and certainly there are South Africans who've written about how repugnant that argument is. But also, I think Warren Mundine the other day implied that the Voice will be like the protection era, that it's the return of the mission and reserve era. I think a lot of Aboriginal people were hurt by that suggestion. But also it's ridiculous. It's not the protection era. It's not by any stretch of the imagination. And so, yeah, there's a lot of ridiculous allegations and suggestions being made and not really being pushed back on either, I would have to say.
Yes, I would agree with that. I mean, that's kind of, I suppose that's a broader frustration that one might have about this whole period, is the extent to which it feels a bit asymmetric. You know, the no case has sort of gone out all guns blazing and putting forward, you know, a sort of a scattergun approach of whatever argument might resonate with whatever person, however ridiculous. And we've seen some, you know, descent into the absolutely absurd in the last 24 hours with claims that the Voice is the reason, or the government's commitment to it is the reason that interest rates are as high as they are, made by the opposition leader and backed by the deputy opposition leader, David Littleproud, today as well. Just extraordinary.
8 out of 44 referendums have succeeded. What I know is about the majority of referendums that have failed has been because of the expansion of federal power. So people say, well, it's Labor. Labor's got a bad record. But actually Australians don't like the expansion of federal power. They clearly don't. They vote no to it every single time. And that's the bulk of the no's. this isn't the expansion of federal power. It's something very, very different. It's a recognition exercise that's been going on for 12 years. It's disappointing what Dutton did, but I think there's a lot of good analysis about why he did what he did. He either had to go along with it and try and claw back some of those teal seats. He cannot win the next election. He has been voted out of every city and urban region, and he's decided to go the other way. And so what we've found in relation to that is that Australians are now just kind of voting along party lines. And so that's why you've seen the vote drop. And we'll see how that lands in the next month or so. But I think the one thing that's most disappointing about the bipartisanship is that Albanese came in last year. So a lot of the voice is influenced by the 8 years of Conservative government. And yeah. I was very disappointed when Little Proud said no before it even seen the detail. To me, that's one of the reasons for the voice, is that so many politicians in this space don't read anything.
Mm.
And so a lot of their policy making is off the back of bureaucrats in their ear who are pushing an agenda, elites in their ear pushing agenda, or anecdote. Yeah, when they get in their jet and they fly around and they say, Aunty Mabel from this, you know, community said this, and therefore, and that's what's serves our community so poorly, is that so much policy is done by anecdote.
Well, we see that kind of cherry picking going on now, don't we, where someone 100%. Will go to one member of a community, use that one member who says, I don't understand the voice or I don't support it, and that becomes rationale then for a politician to cite it. You make this point in the essay. Politicians historically, right through this, through looking, going way back, have just not taken the time to read, to actually read the detail, understand what they're doing.
And the ABC does that a lot. They'll send a reporter out, they'll interview one Aboriginal person, and then they'll contact all the campaigns saying, well, we got one a couple of days ago for Western Queensland, and they said, oh, TOs are saying they don't support it. And we said, well, who are you talking to? And they said, we don't want to give you names. So they're just going out with microphones and they're running these stories regularly on social media. And you know, these Aboriginal people don't know. And I mean, it's the easiest kind of journalism in this space. I mean, I think one of the key things about Little Proud saying no and then Dutton, but especially Little Proud, is that the Nationals held this portfolio for the bulk of that 8 years. And the Australian National Audit Office shows that red tape and bureaucracy increased under the LNP. I don't know why no journalist has ever said to them, what expertise, knowledge or experience do you have that you think you are capable of assessing the voice? You call it bureaucratic, but your government increased the bureaucracy. You say there'll be too much red tape, you increase the red tape. None of this has been put to the opposition in relation to the campaign they're running, when actually they did an absolutely appalling job as government in this space. Their kind of flagship policy, the Indigenous Advancement Strategy, which I write about in the essay, led to the voice. It's their policy.
And the voice, as you also say in that section, is actually a plea for less bureaucracy, for reducing bureaucracy, not for increasing it. So this argument that gets put forward that this is, you know, will establish a whole new strata of Indigenous bureaucrats and you know, people on the gravy train and so forth. This is a kind of a discourse that runs on the
100%. Right. I mean, our people didn't come into Uluru and say we want more bureaucrats in Canberra controlling our lives. That's not what they said. I said this to David Littleproud. They said the absolute opposite. They don't like bureaucrats. They don't like bureaucrats subjugating them and up in their face, telling them what they should and shouldn't do. That's what happens. Our people don't want to move to Canberra. You know, they don't want to be politicians. It's why they didn't call for a voice in the parliaments, why they didn't want designated or reserved seats. Our mob don't want to belong to professional political parties. They don't want to, you know, have to commit to party discipline and ideological positions. They live in communities because they want to represent their own people and live in their own homes where they grew up on country. They don't want to move to Canberra. Nothing could be further from the truth. But what they would like is the agency to be cut in half. There's half of your savings. The agency that executes so much power over our communities and exercises so much of the decision-making that should be in the hands of mob on the ground. They don't want more bureaucracy. They don't want more Canberra in their face. They want to have a voice, and that's something that they're not getting. And that's partly why the system doesn't work, because it is bureaucrats in Canberra dictating. It is politicians who are governing by anecdote. That's why our people want a voice, because right now nobody incorporates their views into the laws and policies. And so we can see the failures. I was just reading this morning the Productivity Commission in Queensland's report into remote communities. And the finding was that the bureaucracy kind of just exists for itself, and that a big part of the work of the bureaucracy in remote communities in Queensland is actually for their own optics, so to take photos of what they're doing to say they're doing things. And then the third dot pointing is devastating. And, I mean, most people would not have read this report. It's 400 pages long. But it says that the whole system exists to maintain Aboriginal welfare dependency because it's an industry. I mean, and that's what that is what's going on in this country. You know, the Productivity Commission at a national level has said this kind of $30 billion that's bandied around, probably about 27% hits communities. Well, the rest of it is a huge industry on which a lot of people are making a lot of money off disadvantage. And they don't want the status quo to change, because they're literally going to lose businesses as a consequence of people getting control back over their lives. And that's the sad thing about what's going on. And I think we need more Australians to understand that it is an industry, but it's not an industry that Aboriginal people are benefiting from at all. And you can see that in the statistics. So Uluru Statement is very much about location. So the Uluru Statement is an invitation to the Australian people, the reason being that in the conversations we had at the Dialogues and out at the Rock, the only way to get change in this country will have to be through the Australian people. We will need to convince them of the problem that exists, the structural problem, what is it, and that this is part of the solution to addressing that. So most Australians accept that the status quo is not working. And most accept that politicians are part of the problem. And we know after decades and decades, you cannot go to Canberra and convince them of anything. You cannot. It's impossible. It's impossible to get them to listen. So
you talk about a sort of a look that comes in their eyes. They don't listen because I think the quote was, they don't listen because they don't have to.
I think it was Mr. Yunupingu who said they don't listen because they don't have to. And, I mean, that is at the heart of the Uluru Statement. Part of the constitutional enshrinement is it's not enough to say, I'll just legislate. They will not listen unless they're asked to listen. It's a powerful thing to mandate that aspect of listening to what it is communities are saying. But that is part of the problem that we've had. And we say and did say at The Rock, you know, there's two elements to this. The whole recognition process was turned around, and the referendum council was set up by Turnbull, and Uluru happened because our people said recognition is not equivalent to acknowledgement. That is its dictionary meaning. And there are some LNP people still prosecuting this argument. I will accept the recognition part, but not the voice, which tells me they have not read anything after 2015. That's really problematic. They have not followed the debate at all. I'm sure it's actually just a ploy, because they're trying to say, oh, recognition is actually acknowledgement. It's not a voice. A voice isn't recognition. No, what happened was we went to Abbott and we said to Tony Abbott, acknowledgement, the dictionary meaning, is not what recognition is, and it's not what our people will accept as appropriate and meaningful recognition. We need a new process where we actually go out to people and ask them what is meaningful recognition. And I would say 98% of the Aboriginal people say no to symbolic recognition.
Yeah, so you talk about the difference between symbolic and substantive, don't you, in the essay? The idea has to actually have some material outcome from it to mean something, because constitutions are where the business of nations are done, I think is the way you put it.
100%. And there's a unity ticket of Aussies and Aboriginal people on this. Mm. Australians also say, don't go to the trouble of a referendum if it's going to be tokenistic and not actually change anyone's lives on the ground, which is the key driving, you know, issue with some of the soft yes now, is they want to know it'll make a difference. Australians want change in this space. And so a symbolic form of recognition that the LNP support, that's not going to do anything. Noel Pearson calls it a plaque in the Constitution. All it is a statement of fact that says we were once here, we are still here and we'll be here forevermore. That's it. It doesn't actually empower anyone to do anything. It doesn't compel the state to do anything. And there's zero evidence across the world that symbolic recognition in constitutions change any of the material conditions of people's lives on the ground, whether it's non-Indigenous or Indigenous. So, you know, recognition in the sense of constitutional recognition, and this has been the case in Gillard for 12 years, is that it sits on a spectrum. There's weak recognition and strong recognition. The weak end is forms of recognition that do nothing. They're, as Noel says, they're the flowery plaques in the constitution, and they're called weak because they don't compel the government to do anything. They don't prohibit the government from doing anything, and it doesn't empower Indigenous people. At this end of the spectrum, the strong end of recognition, are mechanisms that you put into the constitution that do prohibit governments from doing anything. For example, passing racist laws, or they compel governments to do something like setting up a voice, or they empower Indigenous peoples. So there's a spectrum of reforms, and it's not, you know, you, like the dialogues did in any country, you sit in a room and go, well, the political and legal temperament of this nation means you can't go all the way to that end of the strong spectrum, but the weekend's not going to get you anywhere. So you've got to find out, well, what is it that will be possible in terms of political imperative? Because that's really important. That is it's all right to be in the streets as an activist saying, rah, rah, I want this. It's a different thing to go to Canberra and break bread with people that you don't normally talk with to get a substantive change like this. And so voice was what came out of the Uluru process, and partly I think because communities felt so invisible and voiceless and powerless in their own situation. It was heavily informed by the Abbott government Indigenous Advancement Strategy, which is still in place. That strategy decimated the sector so much so that when we went out to do the dialogues, people were not happy and not in the mood to discuss recognition. They'd lost programs, policies, funding, jobs, all with a stroke of a pen, because the Commonwealth bureaucrats and the politicians didn't bother to check what they were scrapping. And they just scrapped the bulk of the sector and put it into one bucket and then asked MOB to apply for their money again. And the first round of money that the Australian National Audit Office found went to something like 70 to 80% of non-Indigenous organisations, many of which were funding their Reconciliation Action Plan initiatives. And a lot went to not-for-profits like Save the Children, who delivered programs that Blackfellas used to deliver in their communities like Yarrabah. They took over all of the Indigenous services. And that all happened under the last government. So voice is recognition. Recognition is voice. That is what our people are saying, is meaningful recognition of us in the constitution. But your point about location is really critical. This is about us coexisting on this continent together. When we talk about the Uluru Statement, when we talk about country, when we talk about our relationship with other Aussies, we're talking about location. And we need to find ways of living and working together. And right now, where we are situated in terms of the Australian polity, and our voice is not recognised in the constitution, we are not recognised in that constitution, then, you know, we're not even co-located as a peoples together.